out. Then she stops her fine hoof when she finds she's alone. And she's frightened and she starts to run. She runs till she comes to a crumbling down bridge. Then she lowered her shoulders and swung. She swung till she come where the grass tasted sweet. Then she took to her feet and she ran. She ran till she come to the hospital gate. Well, old paint, your dear painter is gone. Is cold. My colors are clotted and gummed. I wander alone in a darkening waste, wondering when will my master come home. To a vanishing dream. Then they try to save me in the news. Then they work with their rollers to cover my face. I will face you again, but not soon. A boy of 15 at the Wildwood School in Cape May, where he crashes his frame against the boys on his team, and some frightened dog bolts away.
That wraps up the show this week. We just heard Okkervil River and Will Sheff with Tommy McHugh. And before that, Vampire Weekend and Classical. And yeah, I hope you enjoyed the show this week. Don't forget about those Decemberist tickets, the giveaway. Your last chance to enter is tomorrow. All you have to do is go to News Show WRCT and just find the post, Decemberist posts, and you can just enter right there, and you can win some tickets. So stick around. Courts in Session is coming up next with Eric, and that's it for me. I will be back next week, and have a great week, everyone. Bye.
Well, we have a real mystery on our hands, my friends. We simply do not know why Republican Governor of South Dakota Kristi Noem can't or won't answer a simple question. Did you meet North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un? The controversy started over the weekend when Kristi Noem was asked about a part of her forthcoming book, generating controversy, of course, because she brags about shooting a dog as being evidence that she can make tough decisions. That led to a further review, including a section where she says, "I remember when I met with Kim Jong-un." There's no record that she met Kim Jong-un. It is, of course, a major thing to meet Kim Jong-un. When Dennis Rodman, the former basketball player, was hanging out with Kim Jong-un, he all of a sudden became the American with the most firsthand knowledge of the reclusive dictator. So it's a really big deal. When she's asked about it, Kristi Noem says, "When I found out that was in the book, I had it removed. And I don't talk about my conversations with other world leaders," except she did talk about it in the book until people asked about it. So this is already the setup for this story. Interviews over the weekend, she wouldn't answer the question. She's continuing to simply not answer the question, raising even more questions about why she's answering the question in this way. Here is Kristi Noem yesterday on CBS Mornings, and she continues to not provide anything approximating a straight answer to what is a very simple question. Did you meet Kim Jong-un or didn't you? And why is it in your book? Let's take a listen.
Person, let's talk first. We don't want to talk about a lot of topics that you address in the book, but the book is called No Going Back, but it sounds like the publisher, Center Street, is going back on a couple of the details in the book.
Oh, I don't believe so.
Specifically, when you write in the book, "I remember when I met with North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un. I'm sure he underestimated me. That, as I understand, is now being removed from the book at your request."
Yes. When I became aware of that, we changed the content, and the future editions will be adjusted. And, you know, I appreciate that. I've met with many, many world leaders. I've traveled around the world. I should not have put that anecdote in the book. And at my request, they have
that
removed
specific
it.
How meeting didn't happen.
Now, of course, I should not have put the anecdote in the book. Because of what reason? And that's what we'll get to. And that's what the interviewers are trying to get to here.
And at my request, they have
that specific meeting didn't happen.
How I'm saying that I'm not talking about that meeting. I'm not talking about my meetings with world leaders.
But you there's do some talk that about are in meetings the book. With world leaders.
There's some that are in the book, and then there's some that's not in the book. Many
but
of them actually.
Why are there two specific mentions of meeting Kim Jong-un and talking about him, and a specific memory? "I'm sure he underestimated me, having no clue about my experience staring down little tyrants." Did you tell your ghostwriter to write that?
I've specifically have worked on policy for over 30 years. And over that time, I have traveled around the world.
If you're scratching your head or pounding your head against the wall saying, why can't we just get an answer to this question? It is bizarre. This is indicative of either deep dishonesty or some kind of disconnect from reality.
And I have met with leaders around the world. And that anecdote, I've asked them to change the content, and it will be removed.
It's a simple question. Did you or did you not meet with Kim Jong-un?
That's the answer that I have for you, is that it will be adjusted. And as soon as I became aware of it, that content.
So the most charitable interpretation of this is that Kristi Noem met with Kim Jong-un. It's not a meeting that is supposed to be public. It relates to some kind of classified or something, whatever. And she's realizing, you know what? I shouldn't have acknowledged that I had this meeting. I met with him, but I very belatedly need to keep it on the down low for reasons of national security or whatever. We have no evidence that that's the case, to be totally clear. I have not a shred of evidence that that's what's going on here. But that would be the most charitable possible interpretation. She was asked about this again a number of different times now, and she continues to just not give a straight answer. Here she is with former Trump economic advisor Larry Kudlow, who now has a show on Fox Business. And once again, she says, "I wanted it removed from the book." And remember, she voiced the narration, the audiobook to her book. She voiced, meaning not only did it get written into the book at her direction, at the direction of the ghostwriter, we just don't know. She then went and voiced it over and expressed no concerns. She didn't stop the recording process of the audiobook and say, "Hey, you know what? This isn't supposed to be in here." She did it. And then only now is she going back and saying it needs to be removed. So again, ask the same question, No answer.
And the Kim Jong-un business, did you meet him? Did you not meet him? Did you cross the DMZ? There's some confusion about that. The Margaret Brennan interview yesterday, a word on that?
Oh, I've been in the DMZ. I've traveled all around the world. I've traveled all around the world and met with world leaders.
Remember that, again, there's no answers to the question here. I went to the DMZ and I've met with world leaders all over the world. The question from Larry Kudlow was, did you meet Kim Jong-un or Kim Jong-un, as he says?
As soon as this was brought to my attention, I wanted this removed from the book.
Right.
And I'm not going to talk about it. I'm not going to talk about meetings that I've had with world leaders. I'm just choosing not to. And so when it came to my attention, I asked for that to be taken out, that name.
Now, a great question would be, how did it get into the book in the first place, Christy? Governor, how did this end up in the book? Did you tell the story to your ghostwriter? Did you what? How is it that it got into the book? And then, by the way, as is often the case, this devolves into native English speakers just making up words that aren't part of the English language. We'll get to that in a moment here. But if anybody else has an explanation for this other than she lied or it's true, but she's realizing it shouldn't be public, which I don't find super compelling, let me know what other explanation there might be. One other quick note on the entire Kristi Noem meeting Kim Jong-un situation. She doesn't come off as the most as the brightest person necessarily. And it only raises more questions about why this is in the book to begin with. Kristi Noem, the Republican governor of South Dakota, in this media tour to try to sell books riddled with horrible anecdotes and potentially lies. She appeared on Fox News' Jesse Waters show yesterday. Jesse Waters asking her basically the same question everyone's been asking. Did you meet Kim Jong-un? And she comes up with the word that she had the excerpt removed. The excerpt. Now, you might be saying, David, sir, I know about the word exert, like to exert myself by picking up a heavy log. And I know the word excerpt, meaning almost like an anecdote or a portion of a text. But what she had an excerpt removed, what does that mean? I don't know. Maybe she's referring to a medical procedure. Let's take a listen.
And I understand that they're attacking me for it, Jesse.
Yeah, they are. So they're also attacking you. I guess you said you met Kim Jong-un.
Mm-hmm.
Did you meet him?
I've been to the DMZ. I've been to North Korea. You know, people, I don't talk about my conversations with world leaders. And so when I looked at the book and I saw that excerpt, I decided to make the change to the content of the book.
She saw the excerpt and she had it excised. Now, even in this statement, she's lying. She says, I've been to North Korea. I've been to the DMZ. We still have no evidence whatsoever that she's been to North Korea. The DMZ is a buffer zone, a demilitarized zone between South Korea and North Korea. It is not part of North Korea. We still have no evidence that she has been to North Korea.
Book, and that's been done.
So you didn't have a conversation with Kim when you were at the DMZ?
I don't have conversations about my conversations with world leaders. I've been working on policy for 30 years.
Except she does have conversations about her conversations with world leaders because she includes many such conversations in her book. And now she wants this excerpt, or as she calls it, an excerpt, removed. She read it for her audio version of the book. What is the explanation here? Is it she's merely a liar? Is it that somehow she had an off-the-books visit to North Korea and meeting with the North Korean dictator that she's now realizing she doesn't want made public? Which, by the way, if that's what it is, it's now public if she is telling the truth. I still lean towards she's lying and she got caught, but maybe someday we will know the answer. An angry and confused failed former President Donald Trump yelling the names of his friends as he entered court yesterday, the continuing saga of the Trump trial that turns into a sandbox tantrum for a toddler, effectively speaking. Trump asked, "Are you going to testify?" And Trump now says he isn't allowed to talk about whether he's going to testify because of the gag order. Now, understand how many layers absurd this is. We have like three layers of absurdity deep. Let me play the clip first, and then I'll tell you how ridiculous this gag order stuff is getting.
Mr. Trump, is Michael Cohen a liar? Are you going to testify?
This is the first question. As you know, they've taken away my constitutional rights, so I'm not allowed to answer that question. This has never happened in this country before.
And it's not happening now. Trump says he's under a gag order, or a gag order, as he likes to say, and that because of the gag order, he can't say whether he will testify. That is a lie. Last Thursday, Donald Trump said that the gag order prevents him from testifying. That is untrue. On Friday, when he was asked about it, Trump said, no, the gag order does not prevent me from testifying. Monday, Trump is asked, will you testify? And he says, the gag order prevents me from telling you whether I am going to testify. None of this is true. And Trump appears more and more confused by the day, even about just the basics of how the trial is even working. He's angry about the duration of the trial. He's angry about the gag order. He's angry that the judge is able to impose restrictions on when Trump is supposed to be in court and when Trump can opt not to be in court. And then the sort of height of this, by the way, now, I guess to keep Trump awake, they're giving him papers that he can shuffle through. And the papers are articles from his friends talking about how he's being treated so unfairly. Trump does indeed, as he is arriving at court, just yell the names of his friends who say that this is all very, very unfair.
As you know, they've taken away my constitutional rights, so I'm not allowed to answer that question. This has never happened in this country before. It's a ridiculous thing. It's a ridiculous case. I did nothing wrong, absolutely nothing wrong. Take a look at Greg Jarrett this morning. He went on. Take a look at Andrew McCarthy or Jonathan Turley or Mark Levin. It's like they say there's no case here. And yet the judges gagged me, and I'm not allowed to talk about, I guess, his total conflict. The judge is totally conflict. It's totally conflicted, and you ought to take a look at it. And I'm not supposed to be talking about it, but I am allowed to say that the judge has a conflict that, like, nobody's ever had before. You ought to take a look at it. He's taken away my constitutional right to speak.
All right, so none of this is true. Trump's limited gag orders do not violate constitutional rights. They are not violations of the First Amendment. The fact that Trump's friends like Jonathan Turley and Greg Jarrett are saying this is all very unfair doesn't really mean too much in the legal world. And Trump keeps saying he's reading articles about the trial, but the only people he mentions are legal analysts on Fox News. There are plenty of people writing articles about the trial. They sing a very different tune than what Fox News legal analysts are singing. Trump complaining about the fact that there are witnesses that he doesn't like. There are witnesses he just doesn't feel should be part of the trial.
Absolutely no case. It's a political hoax. It's election interference. Anything they can do, and even the witnesses they want to bring up, they have nothing to do with the case. This is a ridiculous situation. Not fair. Not fair. But we will fight. Thank you.
All right. And of course, if there are truly witnesses that would be inappropriate to include in this trial, there are legal processes, and Trump's defense lawyers can say, we objected this witness. We would like to block this witness from testifying. That is something that they are able to do. And then lastly, here is Trump again referring to his printed paperwork, the papers that they give him to try to keep him awake during trial. It does not seem to be working.
It just came out. Columbia just canceled their commencement. Axios.
He has articles printed from the internet. Classic.
Columbia just canceled their commencement. That shouldn't happen. And it also came out that the protesters, many of the protesters, are backed by Biden's donors. Okay? Are you listening, Israel? I hope you're listening, Israel.
So Trump just reading off the headlines for articles. By the way, that Politico article about the protesters being backed by Biden's donors, a widely discredited Politico had to put out a correction. That's like a two paragraph. They had to correct like 8 or 9 different things. It's one of the craziest corrections I've seen. But that's an aside. Trump just walking around with articles, yelling the headlines of the articles at the reporters. These are wild times we live in. Let's hope that at the conclusion, justice will have been done. Let's hear from a sponsor or two, and we'll be right back. All right. So the judge is saying to Trump, shut your mouth or you are going to jail. But is he really? We've seen this story before. CNN is reporting judge finds ex-president for violating gag order again, warns of jail time for future infractions. Judge Juan Merchan has again held Trump in contempt of court and fined him another $1,000 for violating the gag order. Sternly, he did it so sternly this time, sternly warning the former president of the possibility of jail for future violations. He said Trump's statement threatened to interfere with the fair administration of justice and constitute a direct attack on the rule of law. I cannot allow that to continue. Adding, as much as I don't want to impose a jail sanction, I know, I want you to understand that I will have to, if necessary and appropriate. Prosecutors this time accused Trump of 4 violations of the gag order. The judge only concurred with 1. You may recall the judge previously fined Trump $9,000 for 9 earlier violations in posts on Truth Central and on his website. Prosecutors found that there were 10 violations. The judge said there are only 9, and therefore the fine is $1,000 each. You know, for all the talk about the 2-tier justice system that benefits Trump, that doesn't benefit Trump, that benefits Democrats, we're not seeing any of that. What we are seeing is financially meaningless fines imposed on Trump for violation after violation after violation of gag orders, with the constant background threat of we're going to put you in jail. And yet, of course, it never happens. And to be honest, I don't know that the judge is actually serious. Now, if Trump continues violating the gag orders, I hope that the judge is serious and he's ready and willing to put Trump in jail for a few days. Secret Service is taking it seriously. We talked 2 weeks ago about how Secret Service is making plans for how exactly would they protect a former president if he did have to spend a few nights in jail. But to some degree, I think Trump wants this to happen. I think Trump wants to see himself as a martyr. He wants to present himself as a victim to his supporters and would-be supporters. He sees going to jail as the way that that would happen. And that's exactly why, I believe anyway, Trump is saying he is ready to go to jail for the Constitution. Let's talk about that next. When Trump exited the courtroom yesterday in his first of 4 criminal trials, he made the declaration that he would do the sacrifice and go to jail any day. This is, of course, a reference to the fact that he once again has violated his gag orders. He was fined another $1,000. Yes, I know, $1,000 by the judge for 1 additional gag order violation. He exited court shortly after 4 p.m. Eastern time, and he says that he would do the sacrifice of going to jail any day. Any day he would do it because the Constitution matters. Of course, there is no constitutional violation from a limited gag order on a defendant in a criminal trial. Absolutely nothing whatsoever. Supreme Court has upheld it, but it doesn't matter to Trump. Doesn't matter to his followers. And here he is. He's setting up the martyrdom. He's setting up the victimhood. I will do the jail time to support the Constitution.
And it's a disgrace. And then you have the other thing that maybe is even more disgraceful is the gag order, where I can't basically, I have to watch every word I tell you people. You ask me a question, a simple question, I'd like to give it, but I can't talk about it. Because this judge has given me a gag order and said you'll go to jail if you violate it.
Right.
And frankly, you know what? Our Constitution is much more important than jail. It's not even close.
Of course, it's a total non sequitur, totally irrelevant to compare the two.
I'll do that sacrifice any day. But what's happening here is a disgrace, and the appellate courts ought to get involved. New York looks so bad. The New York system of so-called justice looks so bad between this judge and Gorin and Kaplan. You triple team with corrupt judges. Is a disgrace to our nation. So I should be out there campaigning. And they said 2, and the way I look at it, they're really talking about 3 weeks more. And by the way, they didn't even have enough to fill out the time. You know, we got out early today because they didn't have another witness.
Yeah. Trump really, really upset with the scheduling process here. Listen, on being ready to go to jail, don't threaten us with a good time, sir. And then Trump, wrapping this up just moments later, goes on an unhinged rant about the judge and then out of nowhere says, God bless the USA, and then walks away, ignoring a question about Stormy Daniels.
This judge is a disaster. Between the gag orders and the hatred he's got for me, and everybody sees it, okay? And you see it better than anybody. God bless the USA.
Is Michael Cohen a liar? Is he gonna name
all right, I always wait thinking that he might add something, and sometimes he does.
All right, Trump adding nothing there, spitting out God bless the USA and walking away. So he is not happy, threatening us with a good time, saying he's willing to go to jail. We'll follow it. We'll see if that's where he ends up. I tend to doubt it. Donald Trump is now going after President Joe Biden with a new attack, an attack that feels more like a confession than anything else. Donald Trump now says that President Joe Biden cannot read. Now, this is a particularly interesting allegations or confessions moment, because as we've studied before, it's not clear Trump really is able to read comfortably. So we're going to get to that in a moment. Here is Donald Trump in video from Mar-a-Lago saying Joe Biden cannot read. This is the latest Biden dementia story. As you know, Biden doesn't know what day it is. He doesn't know that he's president. He doesn't know his wife's name. He doesn't know his name. He can't walk. He can't speak. Now he can't read either.
Well, you're the guy who's mentally incompetent. He can't read. Okay, look, see these stairs? They're big, right?
Right. These stairs are very big. So the new one, of course, now is that Joe Biden cannot read. Now, this is particularly interesting with Trump because so many of his attacks on Joe Biden reek of Trump's own insecurities. You might remember that back in 2017, we did a viral video called, uh-oh, does Donald Trump know how to read? And it looked at the combined circumstantial and witness evidence that Trump really can barely read and that his lack of reading ability is the source of many of his struggles. It doesn't mean he is literally illiterate. It just means he has limited reading capacity. Remember, of course, that his co-author from the book The Art of the Deal, Tony Schwartz, once said, quote, "That's why he so prefers TV as his first news source. Information comes in easily digestible sound bites. I seriously doubt that Trump has ever read a book straight through in his adult life. Indeed, Trump has never really mentioned reading a book in his adult life. And we have this is now 8 years old already. We have deposition video of Trump where he does seem to be doing everything he can to avoid having to read from transcripts. And it's very strange. First, he says that he doesn't read leases as a general concept.
Did you review the lease at all before you signed it?
No.
How many leases like this have you reviewed in your career?
Signed or reviewed?
Reviewed.
Not too many. I signed hundreds.
So Trump does admit in testimony that he doesn't actually read the documents that are relevant to his business. Later in the same deposition, he's asked to read a portion and his lawyer objects. His lawyer doesn't want him reading anything or trying to read anything.
You did not review this section of the lease, monetary damages. This is in the remedies section.
I did not, no.
Okay. Would you be able to read this section and tell us what your understanding of it is?
Objection. Mr. Trump isn't a lawyer.
I mean, do you want me to read it? It's long.
It is long.
It's very long.
It is long.
Now, this is, again, resistance to reading. And then Trump suddenly says he needs his glasses in order to do it, something that we're not actually aware of Trump needing. And his lawyer seems increasingly nervous about Trump trying to read stuff out loud.
I would like you to read just the monetary damages section, starting at the number one in the middle of the page, just there, the rest of that, and to the end of that. It continues on the next page, and tell me what you think, reading that, you as the landlord are entitled to get from the tenant in the event of a tenant breach in the way of damages.
I don't have my glasses. I mean, I am at a disadvantage because I didn't bring my glasses. This is such small writing.
All right, well, well, if the witness can't actually physically read the language, that's
a
problem.
It's very small writing. I can make it out. Do you want me to try?
Well, we can have a bigger copy made of these pages.
Let me just do it.
All right, I have to place on the record a hearty objection.
Oh boy.
Yeah, it's all damages that the landlord may sustain, including all legal fees and everything else involved. Looks like everything in the kitchen sink to me.
All right.
And you have.
So in any case, in some literal sense, of course, Trump is able to read to some degree. He's reading every one of his speeches off of a teleprompter, but Biden can certainly read as well. And for Trump to be saying Biden can't, Trump is probably the last guy who should be talking about anybody else's reading. So he's throwing everything at Joe Biden that he can. I hope that this is not going to be enough to put him back in the Oval Office. But at this point, only time will tell. It's great to welcome back to the program today Johann Hari, who is the author of multiple New York Times best-selling books. The new book is Magic Pill, The Extraordinary Benefits and Disturbing Risks of the New Weight Loss Drugs. The book is out today. Johann, it's so good to have you back on.
Oh, David, I'm so happy to be with you. Cheers.
So let's start with, I mean, what's interesting about this book is it also relates to your personal experience. You started to use, I want to make sure I'm pronouncing it right. Is it Ozempic or Ozempic? What's the correct pronunciation?
So the correct pronunciation is Ozempic. Sorry, you don't know, that's the extremely annoying jingle in the adverts. It's Ozempic, yeah.
Ozempic. So yeah. You started using this concurrent with your research and writing of this book. Talk to us about your path. You started using it. Why? What were the side effects? What were the results?
I'll never forget the moment I learned about the existence of these drugs, because from the moment I learned about them, I felt so conflicted. It was the winter of 2022, and it was that moment when the world was opening up again, and I got invited to a party for the first time in ages, and I decided to go. In the Uber on the way there, I felt a bit kind of self-conscious because I gained quite a lot of weight during COVID. I was quite fat at the start, and this party was being thrown by an Oscar-winning actor, and I felt like it'd be a bit awkward. And then I suddenly realized, oh, loads of people I know gained loads of weight during lockdown. In fact, most people. Maybe they're all going to gain weight. It's going to be fascinating to see these Hollywood actors with a bit of chub on them. So when I arrived, it was really weird. It's not just they hadn't gained weight. Everyone was gaunt. Everyone was visibly thinner. Everyone looked like their own Snapchat filter, like cleaner and clearer and sharper. And I was stumbling around in a bit of a daze, and I bumped into a friend of mine on the edge of the dance floor. And I said, looks like everyone really did take up Pilates during lockdown.
Right.
And she laughed, and I didn't know why she was laughing. And she pulled up on her phone an image of an Ozempic pen, and she said, well, it ain't Pilates, right? And I didn't know at the time what it was. I didn't know that we now had a new kind of weight loss drug, which works in a completely new way, which causes the average person who uses it to lose 15% of their body weight. And in fact, the next in this class of drugs, which will be available next year probably, causes the average user to lose 24% of their body weight. And I immediately felt really conflicted because, look, I'm older now than my grandfather ever got to be. He died when he was 44 of a massive heart attack. Loads of the men in my family get heart disease. I knew that being obese as I was makes it much more likely you'll get heart problems, and in fact makes over 200 known diseases and complications more likely. So I could immediately see, wow, if there is a drug that really reverses or massively reduces obesity, there's potentially huge positive health benefits there. But I also thought, wait a minute, we've seen this story before. Every 20 years or so, a new miracle diet drug is announced. We're told it's going to change the world, save us all. There's always a stampede to take it, and they always discover it causes some kind of horrendous side effect that means it has to be pulled from the market. I thought, well, is that likely to happen again? So really to understand this, I went on this big journey all over the world. Like you say, I took the drug to write about it, and I went on this huge journey from, Iceland to Minneapolis to Okinawa in the south of Japan to interview the leading experts on these drugs, the biggest defenders, the people who created it, the biggest critics of these drugs. And it's kind of weird. I'm sure this will emerge in our conversation, David, but at the end of it, I know much more about the extraordinary benefits and the 12 disturbing risks, much more about what it's going to do for the culture. But to totally level with you, I'm still pretty conflicted. The truth about these drugs is genuinely complicated.
So you start taking it the first time, and it's a self-injectable for people who may or may not know. What happens the first time?
It's the weirdest feeling. I woke up 2 days after I first taken it, And I was lying there in bed and I thought, oh, I feel something really weird. What is it? And I couldn't locate in my body what it was. And then I realized I had woken up and I wasn't hungry.
Mm.
I don't remember that ever happening to me before. And I went to, there's a diner near where I live. And I went up there and I went in and I ordered what I used to order for breakfast every morning. It was a big brown roll with loads of chicken and loads of mayo in it. And I had like three or four mouthfuls and I just wasn't hungry anymore. I was full. And that just kept happening every time I ate. I just got full really quickly. It's like kind of shutters come down on your appetite. And obviously around that time I was interviewing the leading scientists about what is happening inside me. And one of the things that's very disconcerting about these drugs is we actually don't know quite what they're doing to people. There's a few things we do know. If you ate something now, David, your pancreas would, after a little while, produce a hormone called GLP-1. And GLP-1 is basically part of your body's natural signals, just going, hey, David, you've had enough, stop eating, right? It's like the brakes, basically. But natural GLP-1 only stays in your system for a few minutes and then it's washed away. What these drugs do is they inject you with an artificial copy of GLP-1 that stays in your system, not for a few minutes, but for a whole week, which is why, you know, you feel so full so quickly. But initially it was thought this was an effect primarily on your gut, right? It's a hormone created in the gut. But we now know you have GLP-1 receptors, not just in your gut, but in your brain. And that from interviewing the leading neuroscientists and doing a deep dive into their work, it's increasingly clear these drugs actually work by changing your brain. There's a huge debate about how and why, which brings with it a whole other set of benefits and risks.
Mm.
But it makes you realize it's a much more intimate transformation than it might seem at first.
Fundamentally, it seems as though what we're talking about is appetite suppression, right? I mean, whether it's happening in the gut or the brain or in both and in what's happening physiologically, we're basically talking about making people not hungry.
Yeah, actually, most of the experts I spoke to said appetite suppression is not the right way to frame it, which surprised me because I would have thought of it exactly the way you just did. It's more that it boosts satiety. So satiety is a word we don't use that often in English, but we all know basically what being sated is. It's when you've just had enough and you don't want any more. We all feel sated sometimes, whether it's sex or food or whatever it is. And turn out this is a core concept for understanding two really important things. Because at the start, I wanted to understand both the drugs and how we got here, right? Because we're in this bizarre and unprecedented situation. You're slightly younger than me, David, but I was born in 19. I'd really urge everyone to just stop for a moment and Google photographs of beaches in the United States in 1979 and just look at them for a minute. When we look at them, they seem really strange because everyone in them looks to us to be skinny or jacked, right? And you look at it and go, well, where was everyone else that day? What's going on? And then you look at the population figures for the United States. Obesity was extraordinarily low in 1979. Then between the year I was born and the year I turned 21, obesity doubled. And then in the next 20 years, severe obesity doubled again, right? This has never happened before in the entire history of the human species. You have 300,000 years where obesity is exceptionally rare. And then literally in my lifetime, this explosion to the point where now 42.5% of Americans are obese. Why? What happened? And the answer lies with this concept of satiety and with a very specific change. We eat completely differently to how human beings ate before us. If you think about people like my father who grew up in Switzerland, this change, this huge explosion in obesity happens in every country that makes one change. It's not where people suddenly become lazy or greedy or lack willpower or all these other stigmatizing things we say. It's where people move from eating a diet that consists mostly of fresh whole foods that were prepared on the day to eating a diet that mostly consists of processed and ultra processed foods, which are built out of chemicals in factories in a process that isn't even called cooking, it's called manufacturing. And it turns out this new kind of food affects us in a completely different way. And to understand it, there's an experiment that was done just up the street from where I am right now in New York that really explained it to me. It's done by a brilliant scientist called Professor Paul Kenny, who's the head of neuroscience at Mount Sinai here. And it's a very simple experiment. He got a load of rats and he raised them in a cage and they had nothing to eat, but the kind of healthy natural foods that rats evolved to eat over thousands of years. And when that's the only food they've got, rats will eat when they're hungry and then they'll just stop. They never made themselves fat or overweight. They had some kind of natural nutritional wisdom that said, hey, guys, you had enough. Then Professor Kenny introduced them to the American diet. He fried up some bacon. He bought a load of Snickers bars. Crucially, he bought some cheesecake. And he put it in the cage alongside the healthy food. And the rats went crazy for the American food. They would literally dive into the cheesecake and eat their way out and just emerge just completely slicked with it. And they ate and ate and ate and ate. And all that natural nutritional wisdom they've had with the kind of food they evolved for just vanished. The way Professor Kenny put it to me is within a couple of days, they were different animals. And they all became quite seriously overweight. Then Professor Kenny tweaked the experiment again in a way that feels a bit cruel to me as a former junk food addict. He took away all the American food and left them with nothing but the healthy food.
Yep.
And he thought he knew what would happen, that they would eat more of the healthy food than they had in the past. And that would prove that this kind of food expands the number of calories you eat. That is not what happened. Something much weirder happened. Once they'd had the American diet and they were given the healthy food back, and that's all they had, they refused to eat it. It was like they no longer recognized healthy food as food. It was only when they were literally starving that they went back to eating it. Now, this is happening to us. I call this experiment Cheesecake Park, and we all live in Cheesecake Park now, right? We're eating a diet that undermines our ability to ever feel full. And what these drugs do is they give you back your sense of fullness, but they bring with them a different set of risks.
Is the general use of these among those you know and maybe yourself that once one reaches their target weight, you stop using the medication, or is it thought of as a maintenance ongoing medication?
It's a maintenance medication. Now, this is contested for reasons I'll explain, but no, at the moment, the advice is if you stop taking the drugs, you go back to how you were before. So it's more like, say, blood pressure medication. It's not a cure for the problem. It's a treatment for it. Now, there do seem to be some people anecdotally who are taking the drugs, radically changing their habits and, you know, behaviors, and then coming off and maintaining a lower weight, but they do seem to be a minority. The only studies we have of that at the moment are by the drug companies, who obviously have a vested interest in you taking the drugs forever, so we're going to be a little bit skeptical about that, but it does seem most people regain the weight when they stop.
I mean, it seems the problem is that the caloric deficit that's caused by the feeling of fullness will get you to lose weight, certainly, but over the long term, is it going to see you consuming a number of calories that is not actually the right number of calories for one size? And what will it do to nutritional requirements? I mean, it seems like that may be a concern from long-term use.
Yeah, there's 12 big risks of these drugs that I go through in the book. One is exactly what you allude to, malnutrition, right? Some people take too high a dose, don't get enough calories, and get malnutrition, and that's really a serious problem. And in fact, someone in my family was in that position. She just was taking it and was just literally barely eating. That's quite separate from the issue around eating disorders, which is probably my, of all the 12 concerns, the thing I'm most worried about. There's a huge array of risks along with extraordinary benefits to the drug. It's one of the things that's so complicated about this.
The full interview with Johann Hari about his new book, Magic Pill, will be on our YouTube channel, youtube.com/TheDavidPackmanShow. We'll take a very quick break and be right back. All right, this is funny. I think you'll like this. It takes a lot to make Jordan Peterson say, whoa, this is some really weird stuff. This is too much even for me. But that's exactly what Russell Brand did. Now, we've already done deep dives before into the whatever you might want to call it, metamorphosis of Russell Brand into a strange sort of conspiracy theory supporting almost guru type figure that seems to have sucked in people from left and right into thinking that he is truly the holder of so much unique and important knowledge. Russell Brand, in the clip I'm about to play for you, is interviewing Jordan Peterson. Or maybe Jordan Peterson is interviewing Russell Brand, better said. It does, you know, with these things, it's often hard to tell because they're often just rants that pass each other like two ships in the night. Russell Brand manages to confuse Jordan Peterson with a taste of his own medicine. I'm going to play for you Russell Brand's rant, which would be exactly the sort of thing that you would expect Jordan Peterson to do. Now, if you're not watching this, if you're only listening, it is true that part of this is visual. The looks on Peterson's face as he is listening to this bizarre rant. And by the way, we see the word Kafkaesque appear. Russell Brand uses the word Kafkaesque. What I would argue is Kafkaesque is this rant itself. Okay, so strap yourselves in. If you're only listening, imagine a bewildered and perplexed look on the face of Jordan B. Peterson.
It's difficult to avoid, I feel, Jordan, is the sense that not only is there this, you know, and you, it's something you touched upon earlier. You said, no, it's not only force, you know, and I sort of offered you that perhaps the benevolence that this force has issued, but could be, and this is of course reductive, an inadvertent side effect of tyranny. And please be aware that I am apprised of the fact that the forms of tyranny that are emerging now, apparently in opposition to these old school, not to be repeated, let's face it, militaristic, demagogic, populist strongman forms of tyranny that we're being continually warned of are far more terrifying. The Kafkaesque, bureaucratic, banalized, invisible, dreadful, we're here to help, I'm afraid your inquiry can't be heard. This is diabolical. Huxley's hell terrifies me even more than Orwell's, although plainly we're in some amalgam with beautiful gilding from Kafka in the sort of unknowable quality. Where is the judge? What is the trial? Who's doing all this stuff? And it seems to me that there must be, even if we are to say it's about power, even if we are asking, who is it, an internal struggle? Is it my power over my instincts and the expression of those instincts in conjunction with culture that I might call self over time?
Right.
There seems to be some other agent. There does indeed seem to be a serpent. There do indeed appear to be fallen angels. There do indeed appear to be ulterior forces at work. For I am struck that when I was an emblem of this culture in my hedonism, I was gloried and made much of.
All right, I'm going to stop it. Brand comes off as a narcissist with a persecution complex, increasingly focused on generating these elaborate expressions of his thoughts without communicating any substantive idea. Now, there's another similarity. When we talk about these sort of guru-like figures that are often followed, not because their opinions are so clear, but because their opinions are completely the opposite of clear. One of the things we're seeing is a similarity in the rantings of Jordan Peterson and Russell Brand. That's similarity number one. Similarity number two is that their most devoted followers, at least until they realize that none of this stuff makes any sense, when someone like me says, this is not communicating substantive and concrete ideas or giving you anything to achieve a meaningful result, this is just, these are deliberately ornate and elaborate musings of absolutely no meaning or value. The followers of these guys will come to me and they'll say, David, you're not smart enough. You're not knowledgeable enough. You're not intelligent enough to understand what it is that they are saying. That's a classic when you get into this guru cult world. And increasingly, Russell Brand is sort of a guru cult type leader, sort of a hybrid between like a Trump and a Tulsi Gabbard, where some people remember they saw Tulsi Gabbard and they said, this is the real leftist. This is the real, this is who really knows what we need in this country. And so a lot of the defenders will say, David, you're just not smart enough to understand the concrete and substantive ideas that Russell Brand is communicating in this rant. Well, tell me what they are then. I would love to know what they are, because he's doing something that is really common of these cult leaders and guru-like figures. He's using elaborate and verbose speech to sort of mask the fact that there is extraordinarily little substance here. Now, people wrote to me and said, David, this reeks of stimulant use as well. I have absolutely no comment on that whatsoever. I'm just not familiar enough to with Russell Brand to know whether that's a thing. And the other interesting aspect to this is that Jordan Peterson, in his more psychological issue commentary, will often talk about personality disorders. There are all sorts of Jordan Peterson lectures floating around where he talks about personality disorders. And he so often ends up finding himself wrapped up in conversation with people who seem to have many of those very same disorders, narcissistic traits, Russell Brand, and I won't list others, but you could probably guess who they are. And in those cases, he's relegated to acting as though they're presenting novel and fascinating ideas with which they can grapple substantively. So it's really wild stuff, this entire kind of guru sort of space. is fascinating. And it's fascinating in part because the followers that they build up, and it could be Trump, could be Jordan Peterson, could be Russell Brand, or could be others. The followers seem particularly susceptible to this type of cultish thinking and defense of their glorious leaders until such time that they become disaffected by them. Hey, I want to play a clip from a Tucker Carlson interview with Joe Rogan that we did not previously get to. And I do think it is interesting. And it's sort of like a full circle moment in terms of what these sort of pseudo populist figures like Tucker Carlson have become. I'm going to play a clip for you where Tucker Carlson says to Joe Rogan that conspiracy theorist Alex Jones seems to be some kind of a prophet with a supernatural ability to see the future. How are these serious people? Take a listen to this.
How'd that happen?
Right. How did he do that?
No, he's channeling something.
You think
that's
so?
Super. Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
There's like no other. I mean, tell me how he did it otherwise. I've asked him about it. How did you do that? At length, he had dinner in my barn recently. We're talking about this. How'd you do that? I don't know. It just came to me. And that's real. That is real. The supernatural is real. And I don't know why it's so hard for the modern mind, I guess, because it's a materialist mind, to accept that. But what you see, and that's not a new phenomenon. It's happened throughout history. There are people called prophets. And there are people who were prophets who weren't called prophets. But there are people who have information or parts of information, bits of information, visions of information come to them. And then
yep, there you go. It is true, Tucker is right, that in the materialist framework, there is a resistance to accepting that Alex Jones' grand ideas may be coming to him supernaturally as a prophet. That's true. But it's not limited just to the materialist world, where that would be something we're skeptical of. In the world of common sense, we would also be skeptical of that. In the world of actually thinking about the insanity of the things that Alex Jones says and then saying, wait a second, those sound like the rantings of a lunatic, not the prophecy of a supernatural being connected with something that is unable for us to see, hear, or touch. So I think it's very, very important when people get sucked into, well, you know, I don't have to agree with everything Tucker says, but to some degree, he is a voice of reason. He's a voice for the average person. He is communicating what so many people think or whatever the case may be. Understand that he is asserting, and whether he believes it or not, I don't know. I know some people say Tucker doesn't believe this stuff. He just knows where his bread is buttered. And this is now the sort of stuff he has to say. If those are your views about Tucker Carlson and his connection to rationalism, and then he says Alex Jones is developing prophecy by some supernatural power that he has, I would say let's stop a little bit short of crowning Tucker Carlson as someone we might disagree with, but who has really great ideas. That is not a really great idea, that I can tell you. We have a voicemail number. That number is 2192-DAVID-P. Here's a caller who's coming to me reporting that people are stealing the bonus show. They are stealing the bonus show. What? Listen to this.
Hey, Dave. I listen to your podcast every day, a website member, so I get the bonus show, you know, where you want to make money, but everybody else that tries to make money to fund themselves is bad.
Yeah.
But now I noticed that other political commentators are also doing bonus shows. Jesse and Brittany are doing bonus shows, and I doubt it. And Luke Beasley's got a bonus show.
Uh-oh.
So, hey, your good ideas are spreading. Also, I thought I would just tell you that your show, or you, keep me centered. I listen to other political podcasts, and they get a bit fiery, and they're throwing out their opinions that so-and-so belongs in jail, you know, Trump, or you know, any of Rudy who got indicted, you know, put him in jail, lock him up, or whatever. But you stay centered. You believe in law and order and due process. I mean, I'm not saying that maybe you don't think in the back of your head that maybe they should be in jail, but you at least let the legal process play out.
Listen, I am trying to make it clear that my principles hold true no matter whether we're talking about a Democrat or a Republican, okay? Whether it's a Democratic congressman or senator, or whether it's Trump or some other Republican, we need to follow. We actually must support law and order. Now, as far as people stealing the bonus show, listen, the most imitation. What's that phrase? Imitation is the most sincere form of flattery. That's where I will leave it. We have a fantastic bonus show for you today. We are going to talk about the latest with bird flu. What is going on? It's getting ugly already. On the dating app Bumble, women no longer have to make the first move. There are significant controversies about this, wrapped up with feminism and rights and all these different things. We will talk about it. And Senator Bernie Sanders says he is running for re-election. He would be 89 at the completion of his next term, should he win. There are mixed feelings about this, even from the Democratic side. We will discuss all of it and more on the bonus show. Get instant access by signing up at joinpacman.com. I hope everybody had a good weekend. South Dakota Republican Governor Kristi Noem did not have a good weekend. If you thought her biggest problem this week was going to be bragging in her new book that she shot a dog dead on her farm when it was 14 months old, that is no longer the biggest problem. Kristi Noem has now been caught making up whole cloth that she went to North Korea and that she met North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un. Neither is true. She appeared yesterday on Face the Nation with Margaret Brennan. If you have an aversion to cringe, you may want to turn this video off. She, Kristi Noem, is asked directly, did you meet Kim Jong-un? Your book very clearly says it. It's not alluding. It's saying, when I met Kim Jong-un. And the answer is obviously no. And Kristi Noem spits out an implosive word salad and sort of refers to the I had the book changed. Well, didn't you write the book? Did you forget you didn't really meet Kim Jong-un? This is the worst of the worst of the worst of these people. And this is what MAGA is. I met Kim Jong-un. Did you? We're looking into how that got in the book. And I asked my publisher right away to remove that. Right. But did you write it? Because you knew you didn't meet Kim Jong-un. Look at this. Maybe get the kids out of the room for this one. It's too cringy.
So you write about lessons learned in leadership, and you bring up some specific incidents I want to ask you about. You talk about meeting some world leaders and one specific one. Quote, I remember when I met with North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un. I'm sure he underestimated me, having no clue about my experience staring down little tyrants. I've been a children's pastor, after all. Did you meet Kim Jong-un?
Well, you know, as soon as this was brought to my attention, I certainly made some changes and looked at this passage. And I've met with many, many world leaders. I've traveled around the world.
You'll notice there's not a yes or no in here.
As soon as it was brought to my attention, we went forward and have made some edits. So I'm glad that this book is being released in a couple of days and that those edits will be in place and that people will have the updated version.
So you did not meet with Kim Jong-un. That's what you're saying.
No, I've met with many, many world leaders.
Can you imagine? Hey, would any of my viewers accept this sort of equivocation from me? Imagine if in my book I said, hey, I met Gandhi. And then in an interview, I'm confronted and said, David, you wrote in your book that you met Gandhi. You didn't meet Gandhi, did you? Listen, as soon as it was brought to my attention that my book says I met Gandhi, the book I wrote, by the way, as soon as that was brought to my attention, I didn't hesitate at all. I showed strength. I contacted my publisher right away and I said, we've got to change this. Oh, so you didn't meet Gandhi, right? I've met all sorts of different people. I interviewed all sorts of members of Congress. None of you would accept that. You would all rightfully cancel your memberships immediately. How is this acceptable?
Leaders, I've traveled around the world. I think I've talked extensively in this book about my time serving in Congress, my time as governor, before governor, some of the travels that I've had. I'm not going to talk about my specific meetings with world leaders.
Except she talked about it in her book, and it was a lie. Now she won't talk about it.
I'm just not going to do that. This anecdote shouldn't have been in the book. And as soon as it was brought to my attention, I made sure that that was adjusted. So the book is not released until Tuesday. And so we're doing all that we can to make sure that those changes are made. And I'm going to continue to focus on what this book is.
Disgusting.
And the blueprint that it lays out for the American citizen on all of the things in the background and stories of my life, but also what I think that needs to be identified identified in politics and what's broken today. I talk about how broken the money game is, how broken it is that...
David, you say in your book you moderated a presidential debate in 2004. That's not true, is it? This was brought to my attention just before publishing that my book contains an anecdote that shouldn't have been in there. That I moderate, and I've participated in debates and I have moderated debates. But the anecdote that I moderated a presidential debate, I'm working with my publisher to figure out how did that get in the book? What?
That we've got consultants that are getting rich off of elected officials, and then how fake some elected politicians are. Every single person in this country wants someone in elected office that's a human being.
All right. So long story short, the answer here is, hey, Margaret, I didn't meet with Kim Jong-un. I don't know why I wrote that, but I wrote it. I wrote the book, and it's in the book, and it shouldn't have been in the book. That's it. It was a lie. It was untrue. I just delivered a finished manuscript for my book, and I just don't get how this happens if you write it, right? Now, if the argument is, well, she told some stories to a ghostwriter who misinterpreted a story about her meeting Kim Jong-un and then put it in the book, and then she didn't realize it because she didn't read her own book. But they're not claiming that she used a ghostwriter, at least as far as I'm able to tell. Who's her publisher? Did she sign off on the manuscript? Did she read her own script for the audiobook that she presumably recorded? You would think that there are endless points at which this obvious lie would have been removed. And she even continues lying during the interview. She says during the interview she's been to North Korea. She hasn't been to North Korea. She went to the DMZ. This comes up. She's just a liar.
History has been extensive and covered decades.
Right, but so you never went to North Korea.
I make no specifics in this book. I talk about the fact that, yes, I have. I've been there. So
you went to North Korea?
You went to the DMZ, and there are details. There are details in this book that talk.
Okay, so then she slips in, well, I went to the DMZ. The DMZ is a buffer zone of sorts between North and South Korea. It is not honest to say you went to North Korea if you went to the DMZ accessing it from South Korea. It's just not honest. And I know that there are her defenders who will say, well, she sort of did go to North Korea. She went to the buffer zone between North and South Korea. Once you step out of South Korea, you're kind of in North Korea. No, it's a unique situation. It's the demilitarized zone. It is a deliberate buffer zone where you were neither in South nor North Korea. She's just a complete and total liar. There is no way to make this anything other than she is a disgusting liar. And by the way, in the book, she forget about telling the story that she killed her own dog. She suggests Joe Biden's dog should be killed. Let's talk about that now. After telling lie after lie about meeting or not meeting North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un, going or not going to North Korea. By the way, she didn't meet Kim Jong-un. She didn't go to North Korea. Kristi Noem doubled down during an interview with Margaret Brennan yesterday and suggested that, yes, President Biden's dog should be killed. She talks about this in her book, saying, Commander, say hello to Cricket. Cricket, of course, is the 14-month-old dog that Kristi Noem did kill. And she suggests that in her book, Joe Biden's dog should be killed. This came up during the interview with Margaret Brennan. Take a listen to this.
You talk multiple times about it. In fact, at the end of the book, you say the very first thing you would do if you got to the White House that was different from Joe Biden is you'd make sure Joe Biden's dog was nowhere on the grounds. Commander, say hello to Cricket. Are you doing this to try to look tough? Do you still think that you have a shot at being a VP?
Well, number one, Joe Biden's dog has attacked 24 Secret Service people. So how many people is enough people to be attacked and dangerously hurt before you make a decision on a dog and what to do with it?
She's arguing that a dog she has nothing to do with should be killed. Now, listen, whatever decision is the right decision to make about Joe Biden's dog, why is Kristi Noem again talking about killing dogs, other people's dogs in this case?
Living at the White House.
That's
the
question that the president should be held accountable to.
You're saying he should be
shot?
That's
what the president should be accountable to, is what is the number? And I would say about Republicans criticizing me, these are the same Republicans that criticized me during COVID.
Rhinos.
They've criticized me when I've made other decisions in South Dakota to protect my state. And my state today is extremely happy and thriving. We're doing well. We've got thousands of people moving to our state.
If your head just snapped because you're like, how did we get to this topic from the dog killing topic? It's because she just doesn't want to talk about it. She's just changing the topic.
State, because they love the opportunities that are here and the businesses that have come and how we've gotten to be a state that has one of the lowest unemployment rates in the nation. Everybody has an opportunity for higher wages. We've got revenues and reserves. We paid off our debt. We've got a AAA credit rating.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
My name is Duncan Kreps. I'm a senior at Middlebury College, and I participated in the Middlebury Solidarity Encampment. Over the weekend, our camp voted to make an agreement with the administration that meant that our encampment came down yesterday in exchange for significant progress on each of the encampment's demands.
As students around the United States set up Gaza Solidarity Encampments on their campuses, many universities have called in police who've arrested students, sometimes violently, and dismantled the sites. But students at a number of colleges have managed to negotiate agreements where administrators have acceded to some of their demands, including considering divestment from Israel. Today, we're joined by four students from Middlebury College in Vermont, Evergreen in Washington State, Brown University in Rhode Island, and Rutgers in New Jersey. Then we speak with one of over 60 journalism professors who've signed a letter to the New York Times calling on the paper to commission an independent review of a controversial December article alleging Hamas systematically weaponized sexual violence on October 7th.
It was very troubling to professors of journalism to see such a shoddy article be published without a retraction or an investigation. And so it became important for us to write this letter and to send it to the New York Times.
The New York Times has since cut ties with one of the three reporters on the story. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The United Nations warning Gaza could run out of fuel and drinking water today following Israel's seizure of the Rafah border crossing. Israel's facing mounting global pressure not to launch a broader ground invasion of Rafah, where more than 1.4 million displaced Palestinians have sought refuge. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres warned there's no safe place for people in Rafah to go.
Even the best friends of Israel are clear. An assault on Rafah would be a strategic mistake, a political calamity, and a humanitarian nightmare. I appeal to all those with influence over Israel to do everything in their power to help avert even more tragedy.
Doctors in Rafah are warning Israel's seizing of the border crossing and its intensifying attacks on eastern Rafah could lead to thousands of more deaths. Marwan al-Hams is the director of Abu Yusuf al-Najjar Hospital in Rafah, which was forced to close and evacuate its patients Tuesday due to Israeli military operations.
The closure of the Rafah crossing means the death of thousands of patients. Thousands of injured will be martyred. Nutritional resources, medical resources, and humanitarian aid won't enter the Gaza Strip, which means more diseases, more patients needing treatment that isn't available, more patients with chronic diseases, new diseases we won't find medication for, and therefore the number of patients will pile up.
The Israeli newspaper Haaretz reports Israel's planning to hand control of the Rafah border crossing to a private U.S. security company. The paper did not name the firm, but said it was made up of veterans of elite U.S. Army units. Meanwhile, the New York Times has confirmed reports the Biden administration withheld sending 3,500 bombs to Israel last week out of fear the bombs could be used to attack Rafah. But the administration's gone ahead with approving another $827 million for other weapons and equipment for the Israeli military. This comes as Politico reports the Biden administration's indefinitely delayed issuing a report to determine whether Israel's violated U.S. and international law in its war on Gaza. Negotiations are continuing in Cairo 2 days after Hamas agreed to a ceasefire proposal mediated by Egypt and Qatar. On Tuesday, family members of hostages held in Gaza rallied in Tel Aviv. This is Shahar Mor Zahiro, whose uncle Avraham Munder is being held hostage.
We heard from sources involved in the negotiations.